I'm Andrew Dixon, and you're listening to a special podcast remembering the playwright Harold Pinter, who died on Christmas Eve 2008.
Well, Mr. Kidd, I must say, this is a very nice room. It's a very comfortable room.
Best room in the house.
It must get a bit damp downstairs.
Not as bad as upstairs.
What about downstairs?
Eh?
What about downstairs?
What about it?
Must get a bit damp.
A bit. Not as bad as upstairs, though.
No one had ever seen a play like that before. With those pauses, with those non-sequiturs.
How many floors you got in this house, Mr. Kidd?
Floors? Oh, we had a good few of them in the old days.
How many have you got now?
Well, to tell you the truth, I don't count them now.
He realised that conversation between people, dialogue, is not for the exchange of information or emotions or whatever, unless it's very simple. More sugar, please. It's most often to defend oneself, to defend one's status or one's purpose, or to attack somebody else in some way, to define one's right in the territory one inhabits.
In the days since his death, Harold Pinter has been called unique, irreplaceable, the last great playwright. What is true is that there was no one quite like him, either in life or in plays. He was a writer who took politics as seriously as drama. He was a dramatist who made a pause mean as much as a whole script. He was a Jewish boy from Hackney who won the Nobel Prize for Literature. A few months before his death, Pinter came on stage for almost the last time, not in a theatre, but at the British Library in London, to talk to an old colleague and friend, Harry Burton. Pinter was there to talk about the donation of his archive, but it was also an opportunity to reflect on 50 years in British theatre. In this edited version of that talk, you'll hear them reminisce about Pinter's origins in the Rep Theatre of the 40s and 50s, about what it was like to play Hamlet in an Irish convent, and how Pinter reacted to the savage reviews of his first play, The Birthday Party, reviews that came close to ending his career before it had really started. You'll also hear something about the politics that took up more and more of Pinter's life and energy, particularly in his last years. But Harry Burton began by asking Pinter about his relationship with another playwright, Simon Gray, who Pinter directed many times, and whether there was one project in particular which he really enjoyed.
Well, they were all great to do, actually, with one exception, which was The Common Pursuit. I'd given up smoking exactly when we went into rehearsal, which nearly killed me, nearly killed the actors too. And Simon Gray never did give up smoking.
No.
But that made it very difficult. Apart from that, it was a wonderful... the whole thing, 38 years of doing his plays. I always probably loved Quatermain's Terms the most. I just think it was an exquisite piece of work. It was very difficult to distinguish between one and another.
How did you meet?
Well, I was offered to direct Quatermain's Terms, 1970. By Michael Cotterham, the producer.
But how did you and Simon meet originally? How was you, how, did, how
we,
were you?
We met then.
But you directed the film of Butley much earlier than that.
No, not at all.
Ah.
No.
I beg your pardon.
I directed the film of Butley much later. Okay. I did Butley first. Are you talking about Quatermain? What are we talking about?
I'm asking you when you first met Simon Gray and did you first come to meet Simon?
When Michael Codron brought Simon along to meet me in 1970, he sent me Butley, the play, and I'd said, yes, I would love to direct it. And then I met Simon at that point.
So The Room was part of an extraordinary 18 months for you that also saw The Birthday Party and the Dumb Waiter was around at that time, first produced in Germany, and then... as part of a double bill at the Royal Court. The Birthday Party, I believe, I mean, I think everyone knows about the lyric, Hammersmith production and Harold Hobson's extraordinary public statement of support for you. But there was a second production, if I'm right, that Stephen Joseph produced at Scarborough that Alan Ayckbourn acted in.
I directed him.
Which had a different director, I was going to say. It seems to me that it's possibly quite significant, not to say that the first director was a fool, but that something happened between those two quite close together productions. Something happened. The Guardian certainly changed its mind about the play and publicly said, we got this wrong the first time because they saw your production. And I remember someone told me earlier that Alan Ayckbourn said that they came off stage after the first night, some of the actors not at all sure really about what they were doing still, but they came off and with the audience's response in their minds, they looked at you in astonishment, he said.
Who did?
Ayckbourn. In other words, that you had guided them to a realization of that play that had clearly not happened the first time around. The play was the same, let's face it, in both times.
The play has never changed.
So, what...
And I did say to Alan Ayckbourn when I went for the first rehearsal, this is a story he tells, and I'm not sure that it's accurate, but he tells it now, and it's worth repeating because it's a good story, whether it's true or not. But he said to me, can I ask you a question? I said, what? And he said, who am I? Where do I come from? Who are my parents? Did I go to school? Where? What kind of job did I have before I came down to this seaside town? So on. And he said, I said, mind your own bloody business. Just say the lines.
Right.
I can't believe I said such a thing. But still...
Well, some of us have read that story with an expletive in the place of the word bloody, I have to say.
Well, we're in the British Library, aren't you?
Yeah, probably. In the very archives. But it then makes sense to me that when he says he and the actors look at you in astonishment when they come off stage, it's because they've realised that in performing the play... the play's full potential has been realised, and you guided them into that performance. And clearly that wasn't the case in the first production of The Birthday Party. You weren't there, directing, for one thing. And wasn't there some curiosity about the setting of the first production at the Lyric?
Yes, it was totally unreal, which didn't help.
In what way was it unreal?
Well, it was... the designer had a ball. Even in those days, designers... with the plague of English theatre. And they just... He created a conservatory, great big conservatory. this was supposed to be a little boarding house in Eastbourne. And I said, where does this come from? I remember... And he said, oh, they're all over the place, these conservatives. But I was very, very inexperienced in those days, and I didn't really know how to cope. It was my first professional production, and it was taken out of my hands, really. But I've never looked back since then. I've never allowed it to happen again.
No. With Henry and your team, your comrades in Hackney, did you begin going to the theatre in London? Joseph Brearley, your English teacher, had nurtured, I know, a love of language and of poetry and drama. So when did your theatre-going life really kick off?
When I was still at school, Joseph Brearley, my English master, took us to Donald Wolfe's King Lear, which was an eye-opener. And he was... an extraordinary man, this Donald Wolfit. He was a real maverick. He didn't get on with anybody, including me, by the way.
Well, you joined his company briefly,
didn't you? Oh, yes, 1953. And one day, I was so... I played a knight in King Lear, and but I was so excited by his. I saw that production of King Lear six times before I joined his company. And I suddenly found myself on stage with him. And he was so powerful that I started to cough. And out of nerves, out of excitement, I suppose. And I came off stage and walked down the corridor. I always remember this. And suddenly his voice said, "Pinter!" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "You coughed. Watch it." So that was... But before that, I'd seen... Before I joined his company, I had been very fortunate to see an extraordinary collection of actors called about the Golden Generation from 1945 to 1950, really, like Laurence Olivier, Ralph Richardson, Paul Scofield, Michael Redgrave, John Gielgud and Peggy Ashcroft. And they don't make them like that anymore, really. They were all doing Shakespeare in the main, although I remember seeing Peggy Ashcroft in The Heiress by Henry James. I can't remember who adapted it. And they were wonderful actors, really. I mean, in my view, just jumping ahead, if you like, I think there are still some pretty brilliant actors around in the English theatre. But there's only one who really, in my opinion, comes up to that level, that stature, and that is Michael Gambon, who, when he feels like it, can really cut the mustard, you know. Mm. He's in my play, No Man's Land, at the moment, in Dublin, which is coming here to London. And but you don't... What can I say? It was an extraordinary generation of actors. A lot of people learned at their feet. And...
So was it seeing those shows... Presumably at the New Theatre, some of these shows were?
The New Theatre, yeah. I saw Henry IV, Part One, the New Theatre, in about 1945. I think I'm right. Or six, with Ralph Richardson as Falstaff and Laurence Olivier as Hotspur. And that was as good as it gets, really. And I also saw Olivier do Oedipus Rex. At Gielgud and do Much Ado About Nothing, and so on. And then Scofield, suddenly, as a young man, suddenly popped up as Mercutio in Romeo and Juliet, and totally new voice.
And what a voice.
And what a voice. That was very exciting. But I have to say that, just to get the record absolutely straight, that I didn't go to the theatre all that much, nevertheless, because there wasn't much else to see, you know.
Right.
And I went to the cinema. I spent a great deal of time in the cinema in the late 40s. And Russian cinema, French cinema, even American cinema. And there were some great American black and white B films of those days. Very serious ones, too.
And some amazing actors.
Oh, yeah. So it was very fecund part of my life, if I can use that word. If it's allowed in the British Library.
I don't see why not. So
you never can tell, you know.
So that's synthesis. What I feel you're describing in terms of your early awareness of theatre and so forth, there's a synthesis happening between cinema and this extraordinary exposure to the immediate post-war golden age of Shakespeare acting, of classical acting. But then you began, when you began to act yourself, I don't want to overgeneralize, but it's true, is it not, that you played a lot of plays in rep that weren't terribly good yourself? You did a lot of quite ordinary stuff.
Oh, yes, yes. But, before that, I was very fortunate in going over to Ireland, you know, to act in this actor-manager called Andrew McMaster, a Shakespearean actor-manager, his company in 1949-50. And I just answered an advertisement, went to see him, and he said, yes, you can, cigarettes are very cheap. You can get a bed and breakfast for not hardly anything. And you can play Cassio, Horatio, and Bassanio, and I'll give you £6 a week. And I said, well, that's fine with me, I'm sorry.
How old were you at this point?
20.
Wow.
And then finally I did play Iago, actually, to his Othello, which was a hell of an experience. But he did say something to me one day. I was playing Horatio, and he said, oh, we have a convent matinee coming up. He said, on Thursday, I'm exhausted. Why don't you play Hamlet? And this was Tuesday, I think. And I said, I'd love to. At that age, you know, I knew it anyway, you know. I knew the lines, I mean. So I did play Hamlet, that convent matinee. And I saw him in the wings lurking about. And after the show, he said to me, not bad, dear boy, not bad. Next time, be kinder to your mother. But there was never a next time.
Right.
He never invited me to do it again.
Right. And he wasn't so exhausted that he didn't stand in the wings keeping a very beady eye on on your Hamlet.
It's a very nerve-wracking and demanding activity, acting, actually. But I do, it's always been very enjoyable, finally. I remember when I was playing No Man's Land, about whatever it was, about 7 years ago, I suppose, at the Almeida, I had a fridge, and in that fridge I had a bottle of champagne. And before the show, before the first preview, I came into the dressing room with a glass in my hand. And Douglas Hodge, who's no chump, and knew me pretty quite well anyway, said, what's that? I said, they were all drinking tea, by the way. I said, it's a glass of champagne. He said, are you going to drink that before the show? I said, I am. And he said, I'm absolutely flabbergasted. I said, look, if you ever find me drunk on stage, let me know, and I will never do it again. He never did find me drunk on stage, until this very moment.
And you once...
No, I mean, there are various ways of oiling the wheels as an actor.
Well, you once told me about how you overheard Sir John Gielgud and Sir Ralph just before the beginning of a performance of Gnomon. Do you remember that?
I do.
Talking of oiling the wheels.
Yes, I when they were doing No Man's Land at the National, I happened to be in the wings for some reason or another before the show started. And they were waiting to go on. And we'd all heard a lot about method acting in those days. And they were And I heard Ralph Richardson say to John Gielgud, "Where did you have lunch today, old boy?" He said, "Well, the rules. What did you have?" "A very good roast beef. Brussels sprouts." "Oh, certainly beautiful Brussels sprouts. And what about you, Ralph? What did you..." "Oh, the ivy, of course. Yes. I had beautiful Dover sole and some white burgundy, a Chablis, perfect Chablis." And Gielgud said, "Well, how very, very nice. I'm so glad that you enjoyed it." And the stage manager said, "Lights are going up." And they pulled themselves together, went on stage, and started the play. And they weren't talking about their mothers, their fathers, or the fathers and the mothers of the characters, or anything. Mm. They were just talking about roast beef and white burgundy, etc. Mm. So that was a point of view I was always very sympathetic to.
The point of view that actors should act when they go on stage.
That's right, like that.
And just not get too worried about any of the rest of it. But this golden age that we're reflecting on, and the beginnings of let's call it a wave of new writers, a sense of the need for urgent change, an injection of energy into the stage, into the life of the theatre. Do you think that also brought with it developments like method acting? Did it bring change that wasn't so beneficial as well?
Well, I don't know. I'm not a critic, you know. I'm just a working playwright, so I can't theorize, and I'm not a social commentator in that respect.
But did you feel part of something?
What, of a new writing? You mean?
Well,
new?
I suppose the cliché is the angry young men.
No. No, I was always very solitary, actually. I never joined anything much. I never, for example, joined the Royal Court, who did have a thriving body of writers, young, new writers. I was never part of that. They still do, by the way, have a body of thriving writers. I mean, what interests me very much these days is there are writers all over the damn place, and they insist upon writing. Mm. They don't stop, which is very heartening and invigorating. And
what are they writing about?
As I say, they're writing about their own countries, their own lives, and the world. What else? I don't know these people, but I get the sense that that the imagination has really got them by the throat. Their own imaginations, as it did me a long time ago. And they seem to know that too. They know my work.
And doubtless some of them are experiencing or have experienced attempts by others to repress and oppress their freedom to write.
Well, yes, well, you've got that happening all over the bloody place. So I think we have a very... not only freedom to write, but freedom to express their views. I'm not just talking about them, I'm talking about us. I mean, the fact is that this may not be quite on the brief you have this evening, but
we've
if there
long
is such
left a brief.
But I've been really struck by the flabbergasting, breathtaking hypocrisy recently of the moral stance the USA and this country has taken about the Russian invasion of Georgia. You actually hear people like Bush, Brown, Miliband, and I'm sure Blair, if he can still speak, taking a moral position, saying, how can you invade a sovereign country? What? I think it's so blatant, and so it stinks to high heaven, actually. And what I'd like to see is if there a front page headline saying, can we remind the Prime Minister that we invaded Iraq in 2003? Is it possible? Or have we simply forgotten? Mm. I mean, only a million people have died in Iraq, including hundreds of thousands of children. Not entirely, not directly, all of them, but we're responsible for that state of affairs. Mm. And it's put on the back burner. It's almost as if it's never happened.
How is it? We are responsible. This is a question that I wanted to ask you. What is the appropriate response of an individual who feels compelled to try to take responsibility for what has been done by our government?
Well, to say so, for a start, to speak, the appropriate response is simply to look for the truth and tell it. That's my view. I have to say, that's what I try to do. Mm. And although it's getting late in the day, in my life, I mean, I will continue to do so. And I think that is the I'm not alone in this by a long, long way. I mean, there are millions of people all over the world who feel the strongest possible objection to the actions taken in their name, such actions. And the hypocrisy. Mm. I find it pretty sickening, actually. Mm. So,
I think of Stanley towards the end of the birthday party being led away, having had his ability to speak out removed.
That's right.
And Petey saying, don't let them tell you what to do, Stan.
That's right.
But it seems to get harder and harder to get that message, if it is a message, and I don't think it is a message in your play, but to communicate that idea to people when there are so many other influences putting people to sleep at the same time as others, artists, writers, are saying, wake up.
Well, I think you're dead right.
Well, I know I'm right, but what do we do about it?
We do our very best to keep it right there, you know.
This idea of people trying to keep... Do you know what these are?
No.
These are reader's reports from the Lord Chamberlain's office. I brought them, two of them with me on stage because they're so delicious. In terms of the idea of people trying to repress the truth or stop audiences from being allowed to respond to an artist's voice, the reader's report of the birthday party, 24th of the fourth month, 1958, begins an insane, pointless play. Mr. Pinter has jumbled all the tricks of Beckett and UNESCO with a dash from all the recently produced plays at the Royal Court, plus a fashionable flavouring of blasphemy. The result is still silly. I mean, these are extraordinary documents. There is a constant need for vigilance against people wanting to silence the voice of what? When you decided to take writing into your own hands and not be in rep, what was the primary instinct in terms of the audience?
I think it's quite complicated. I wrote poetry from the age of 11, and I didn't ask anybody what they thought of it. I just wrote it. And that's always been my where I stand. I don't ask anybody what they think about what I do. I just do it. So that nothing's changed, actually. I still write poetry, and it speaks for itself. And I don't ask anybody's permission. And but occasionally I do run into interesting things. I wrote a poem which I can't quote simply at the moment because I simply can't remember it properly. But I wrote a poem about a few months ago, which I sent to The Guardian, and it actually contained some obscene language. And The Guardian wrote back to me and said, we're not able to publish this poem because we feel it will anger our readers. And I thought, what? And I said to myself, all you've done are two things, really. You've angered me. And I shall never send you another poem again. Which is the case. So, listen, I'm ready for a drink, actually.
Are you? Well, I can't gainsay that. Would you finish by reading one of your poems? I have a book of poems here. I know that you began poetry, because you told me once, you began writing poetry when you and showed a poem to your father, and it was a love poem.
Yes.
And not everybody knows your love poetry.
Well, I'll read one.
And I wonder whether you would read the poem on the right-hand side of that page.
That's exactly the one I was thinking
of. What an extraordinary poem.
The fact is, my father was a pretty authoritarian man. He was a great fellow, but he used to go to work. He was a tailor, and he got up very, very early. And one day he came down to the kitchen and found me sitting at the table about 6 o'clock in the morning. And I was writing, and he said, what are you doing? What are you doing up at this time of the morning? I said, I'm writing. Writing what, he said. Picked the piece of paper up. He looked at it, and he said, all right, go on. And then he went to work, and I continued to write. You know, when I said, this is the poem I would like to read, which he just offered me, that's true. And it's called It Is Here for A. What sound was that? I turn away into the shaking room. What was that sound that came in on the dark? What is this maze of light it leaves us in? What is this stance we take to turn away and then turn back? What did we hear? It was the breath we took when we first met. Listen, it is here.
Harold, thank you very much.
That was Harry Burton speaking to Harold Pinter at the British Library in September 2008, just a few months before Pinter's death, one of his last public appearances. You can hear a full version of that discussion and catch up on the Pinter Archive project on the British Library's website at www.bl.uk. And for more on Harold Pinter's life and work, including archive reviews, interviews and the best of The Guardian's coverage, head to guardian.co.uk/Pinter. Thanks for listening.